I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Rabbi Steve Leder, Senior Rabbi of Wilshire Boulevard Temple in Los Angeles and author of the new book, More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms Us. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Two Jewish Mavenah in Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinchinim Chen Dinachi and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. Or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It's a little hard to believe, but it's December already, and that means we are in the holiday season, the Hanukkah holiday season, that is. Hanukkah is best known as the Festival of Lights, but historically it is much more than that. Hanukkah commemorates events that took place nearly 2,200 years ago, when the Hellenistic Syrian king Antiochus IV Epiphanes decided to deify himself. A common practice among the successors to Alexander the Great, this meant the king was now supposed to be considered to be a god, and all proper subjects of his Seleucid Empire were required to worship him. They could keep their original god or gods, but everybody now had to bow to statues of King Antiochus that he had circulated to every corner of his extensive empire. One of the least important of those corners in the 2nd century BCE was the primitive backwater called Judea, what we know today as Israel. Most people there, including the majority of the Jewish population, simply bowed down to the statues of the king, whether or not they believed he was really divine. After all, statues were being erected by Syrian Greek soldiers armed with swords, spears, and bows, and the Judeans were armed with, well, nothing. The Syrian Greeks went farther than that, though. They set up the worship of Antiochus in the very temple in Jerusalem. They forbid Jews from teaching their now heretical belief that there was only one God, and that no human image of God could be made or should be worshipped. And they outlawed the practices that supported that contrary belief system, Shabbat, the teaching of Torah, and circumcision, among other things. Still, most of the Jews of Judea kept their heads down, bowed to Antiochus' statue, and cooperated with the Greeks. The predominant emotion among the Jews was fear. If nobody stood up, no one could be struck down. The central authority must be right. It was in power, after all. It had its own religious base in Antiochus and its own idea of ethics. Nearly everyone just went along. But one group of hard-headed, stiff-necked Judeans refused to bow to the Syrian Greeks. They followed the traditional belief in the one God and the Jewish practices of the Sabbath and teaching Torah. They refused to bow to a human being who thought himself omnipotent and infallible. That group, of course, was the Maccabees, led by Mattathias and his son Judah and his brothers, the Hasmonean family. They stood up to the Syrian Greek soldiers, fought a guerrilla war from the hills of Judea, won some battles and lost others, but gradually the rest of the Jews joined their fight for religious freedom. After a hard-fought war, they recaptured the temple in Jerusalem, cleansed it, and reestablished proper worship of the true one God. They established a holiday of religious freedom and dedication, Hanukkah, dedication, that we still celebrate today. Well, the lights of Hanukkah are beautiful, but the valiant daring of the Maccabees means much more than that. Without the courage of that small band of brave Jews, there would be no Judaism today, nor any Christianity or Islam, for that matter, for the belief in the oneness of God was at stake, the freedom to believe and practice as we wish. It was a great and critical victory for freedom of religion in the world. To play us in this morning, here's a setting from our pre-Hanukkah musical preview of this festival coming up December 12th, starting a week from Tuesday night. It's a powerful version of Hanerot Halalu, composed by Zavel Zilberts. We kindle these lights to remind us of the miracles and wonders our God wrought for us for our salvation in those days long ago. Zavel Zilbert's Hanerot Halalu for Hanukkah, coming up in just 10 days. Our guest this morning is a senior rabbi of one of the most prominent synagogues in America, Wilshire Boulevard Temple in Los Angeles, Rabbi Steve Leader. His new book, based in part on personal experience, is called More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms Us, and he has remarkable and powerful insights for us when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Rabbi Steve Leader is the senior rabbi of Wilshire Boulevard Temple in Los Angeles, one of the most important congregational rabbis in the country, and the author of several books, The Extraordinary Nature of Ordinary Things, More Money Than God, Living a Rich Life Without Losing Your Soul, and the new More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms Us. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you. Happy to be on.
Well, speaking of happy, your new book is about suffering, and that's something we deal with. Of course, every human being does. Certainly rabbis do. Why write about suffering now?
I decided to write this book because for the first 27 years of my 30-year rabbinate, I spent, as most rabbis do, a lot of time helping people through incredibly difficult experiences. I was, I have a front row seat to life and a lot of suffering. Then I, 3 years ago, went through an excruciating physical ordeal and realized that while I hadn't been useless to people during those 27 years, there was an awful lot about suffering I didn't know or understand until I suffered myself, and felt that it was important to share these new insights with people. And to try to help people in a different and more substantial way than I had been able to prior to my own experience.
Your own experience was a car accident and then a severe back problem.
Correct, and then surgery and then opioid addiction and depression and then pulling out of all of that and frankly using that pain to make my life better. And that's why the title is More Beautiful Than Before, because while suffering certainly is nothing we'd wish for in our own lives or the lives of others, it's not necessarily useless to us. I say in the book, everyone goes through hell. The point is not to come out empty-handed. And you don't have to come out of suffering empty-handed. It pain is a very powerful teacher if you are willing to learn.
There's a one of my favorite lines in all the movies I've ever seen is in My Favorite Year, where the Jewish guy says to the Catholic girl, Catherine, Jews know two things, suffering and where to find great Chinese food.
Yeah, I like the way I like to put it is a sad Jew is a happy Jew.
Yeah, we joke about it, right? It's so much a part of our culture, and there have been 5,000 years of Judaism or something like that, which only means 5,000 years of persecution. And when we talk about it, we joke about it, but it's not something really just to joke about. It's something really profound about us.
It is, and it's profound about us as a people, and it's profound about us as individuals. And the beautiful thing about Judaism is it always sees darkness as a precursor to light. When does the Jewish day begin? Right at the darkest moment, we end Shabbat with this beautiful song Eliyahu HaNavi, where we look forward to a time of redemption and peace. We end the Seder with next year in Jerusalem. Jews somehow realize it's baked into the culture and the liturgy that every ending is also a beginning, and that the sun really does rise no matter how dark the night. Jews, despite the mythology, are the most optimistic people on earth. We just keep going. One of the first chapter in the book is a Yiddish aphorism, which in English is, when you must, you can. And that's the Jews.
It's a beautiful beginning. We will talk much more with Rabbi Steve Leder. His new book is called More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms Us. When we come back in just a moment here on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So, although the Jewish community of China dates back to the Silk Road, there hasn't been much of one for a long time except occasional expatriates. And yet, you tell me that in China they have a very interesting perception of Jews.
Right. Well, there was a fairly important Jewish community in China during the war when a lot of Jews were granted visas and kind of used Shanghai and a few other places as a transit stop on their way to either North or South America.
They took Shanghai, a lot of German Jews were there during the war.
They took the Trans-Siberian Railroad. Not only German Jews, but Jews from all over Eastern Europe and from what was the Soviet Union.
Right, the so-called Shanghai Ghetto.
Once
the Japanese came in.
There were a lot of Jews, briefly. And many people I know have parents who spent time in China for, 5-10 years en route to a real place of haven. And then by the end of the 40s, 5 years after the war, China was a complete mess because of the revolution and ending up communist. So very few of those Jews stayed. However, what's interesting is, so I have a large number of former students, more than two or three, who at some point in their lives, after graduating from the University of Arizona, moved to China and worked as English teachers. One stayed 5 years. One stayed even longer and ended up marrying a Chinese woman. But he, after a certain point, saved up so much money teaching English that he enrolled in a major Chinese university and got a master's in Chinese language and literature. And he was the only foreigner in that class. So he had to write all his exams and do everything in Chinese.
Wow.
He now has a PhD in the history of U.S.-Chinese relations and is making a career out of what started to be, a temporary stopgap. Anyway, all of my friends who have lived and worked in China and who have anything more than a superficial knowledge of the country tell me that the pervasive view of Jews there, and it's even in school textbooks, so there's such uniformity of thought, the Chinese stamp out minds an assembly line. The image of Jews is they're the smartest people in the world. They're the best with money. If you want to get rich, watch how Jews behave, et cetera, et cetera. And Chinese parents teach this to their kids, not in a negative way, but hold up Jews as a role model of how to behave, how to go to school, how to be careful managing your money, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, it's interesting because in most parts of China, and it's a very large country, as you know, nobody's ever seen a Jew. I mean, there are whole cities of 5 or 10 million people without a single Jew. Some of those cities now, I mean, for example, Chengdu has a national school of Chinese folk traditional medicine. And there's always an Israeli presence at that school. There's between 30 and 50 Israeli students learning Chinese traditional medicine. So there's a little tiny bit of an Israeli presence, and probably in some of the bigger cities, there's a little tiny bit of Chabad presence. But in terms of a real local Jewish community, none. But every Chinese who has any more than a high school education has a rote definition of Jews, and it's extremely positive.
Would that that were so all over the world. Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivi Na Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So we've been talking about the very difficult situation between Israelis and Palestinians, not exactly a new subject. This is the 50th anniversary was this year of the Six-Day War, the 100th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration, also the 70th anniversary of the UN partition plan that eventually led to the State of Israel in 1948. All of these kind of coming together, we had lots of painful things about how difficult the situation is and where it comes from. Where's the tikva, where is the hope, the nechemta, the comfort out of this? And my first thought on that is, if we just took the rational, logical course, Israel would never have existed. There wouldn't have been essentially peace with the Arab countries, official nations, since 1973, really.
Mm-hmm.
You can make a case for Lebanon not being so peaceful. But there hasn't been a full-scale war with the other Arab countries
in
a long time. Thank God, in decades. A lot of things that you couldn't think were possible somehow are possible. And Israel goes on. All we hear about is the terrible conflict there. But when you're in Israel, you don't feel it at all most of the time.
So the nechamta, that first of all, is that we have a state of Israel. Yeah. Right?
Yeah, of
that
course.
We are fulfilling like 2,000 years dream
right.
of...
You know, we always say 2,000 years. It's not even 1,900 years that we didn't have a country. Let's not exaggerate.
Okay.
Sorry,
but there is Nechamta, and we definitely need to acknowledge that we do have a state of Israel, and we do have a democracy. We have problems from here to India and back, but we have a lot to be proud of. That's, you know, need to be said.
Hachaim shalanu tutim.
Yes, mamash. Yeah, our life is strawberries
right.
and cream cheese or something.
Something like that. No, there is a lot. I mean, Israel's an incredible,
yeah,
dynamic,
we have a lot to be proud
place.
Of that. And you right. mentioned, you know, 50 years and 70 years. You know, there is a lot to celebrate. But in terms of hope, when we are talking about the conflict, I agree that we are like the Israeli society, the Israeli people, like feel like stuck and kind of get used to the situation. I would say that in general, there is the minority that's still, you know, hopeful that one day we will, you know, we will go back to have, you know, good neighbors, and the times that people from Beit She'an will go to Jenin, chas v'chalila, on Shabbat, and go to their market.
Or go to Gaza to buy vegetables or,
yeah, or
furniture,
just have
or whatever they used to
or
do.
Just
have friends across,
you know,
the border.
Really.
Because
right? We used to have these times, you know. We
sure.
definitely used to have the time,
in
and I remember
memory,
it.
In your memory.
Yeah, I remember it, you know. On our way to Jerusalem, we will stop and we will buy vegetables on our way. And now, chas v'chalila, we will stop on Gvish Tishi, on 90 Road. But so I would say that it's really worth another discussion about, you know, the development of the Yamin and Small. Because the right and left in Israel, and this is also one chapter did a good job describing how the right and left, how the Jabotinsky, who led the right wing, was like secular, you know, nothing related to
anti-religious
religion. And now with the Israeli right wing is like more messianic, more religion, more, you know, Israel HaShlema. It wasn't like Jabotinsky as well recognized, you know, the Israel HaShlema from different reasons.
The greater Israel concept,
it was,
right?
It was so different. So it's fascinating to understand the left and the wing and the 70 years, how they dramatically changed. The Israeli left went from being like a socialist
really.
And,
yeah.
you know, make sure that the Ma'amad HaPoalim will have their rights, and then now they focused and they give up this dream when the kibbutzim, all the privatization process, mid-80s, and then they tried to find something, so they found the peace process,
right.
you know, and then this is fascinating, and only understanding the process in Israel can maybe lead us to find something, some hope.
I think it's possible, and I think it's, you know, as has been said many times, if you just took what's reasonable about Israel, Israel wouldn't exist. There's always this sense of there's a possibility beyond the obvious, and that's what we have to continue to look for. Thanks so much, Ashrad. We'll talk next week.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life, 322-7035.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. The new rabbi is in the middle of a sermon when he suddenly beckons the gabbai to come over. The rabbi says, "That guy in the third row is asleep. Wake him up." The usher replies, "You put him to sleep. You wake him up." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and stay awake. And now a word of Torah. You know, growing up, my mom used to swear she had four only children. A positive interpretation of this would be that she felt that my siblings and I were treated as though we were each truly unique. Every one of us had distinct personalities and preferences, and she and my dad parented us as though we were all equally precious. The less warm and fuzzy understanding is that we were each so demanding we required the parental attention an only child would have had. You know, raising children and parenting styles and the dangers of parenting poorly are a very important part of the whole book of Genesis. By the time we reach this week's portion of Vayeshev, we've had vivid examples of the disastrous consequences that preferential parenting can cause in a family. Abraham, in part because of his wife Sarah, favors his younger son Isaac over his eldest son Ishmael, and the results of that rejection are still being felt in the Middle East. The Ishmaelites, their descendants, are the Arabs, and the Jews, the descendants of Isaac. Isaac prefers his elder son Esau to his twin brother Jacob, but his wife Rebekah likes Jacob better. The results of their cross manipulations spell conflict and a 20-year exile for Jacob. And now, this week in Vayeshev, we come to Jacob's own cataclysmically bad parenting of his huge brood of 12 sons and a daughter. In particular, we encounter the remarkable figure of Joseph. You know, Joseph is one of the truly spectacular figures in the whole Bible, indeed in all literature. He will be the principal character of the last four weekly portions in Genesis, and his story has been called the first truly modern piece of writing. It is a great tale, only partly about failed parenting and bad sibling rivalry. The Joseph story begins with a bang. Jacob's beloved wife Rachel has died in childbirth, giving birth to the 12th and final Jacobian son, Benjamin. In a pained overcompensation for the loss of Rachel, Jacob spoils Joseph, giving him a famous coat of many colors and then using him as a tattletale spy on his older, tougher brothers. The brothers' revenge is swift. They capture Joseph, sell him into slavery in Egypt, then tell their father that a wild animal has killed him. After adventures that demonstrate Joseph's virtue and his spectacularly bad luck, at least at first, this week's portion ends with Joseph in an Egyptian prison, Jacob in mourning in Canaan, and all hope seemingly lost. The eventual message of the Joseph story is that God's plan will work, but we aren't always party as to why. But a second message is even more important. Our children are all precious. Favoring the good one does no one any good. Treating each with love, as though in fact each of our children was truly an only child, is the Jewish way to parent successfully. Perhaps in successful families, we are all only children. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Steve Leder, will explain why suffering in a Jewish way is crucial to spiritual growth and how we can move from pain to understanding. Find out when we come back in a moment, right here on To Jewish.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term, inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Details emerged last week of the highly classified Israeli intelligence that President Donald Trump revealed to Russian officials back in May of this year. The president's decision to spill the information during a meeting with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov brought Israeli spies' worst fears to life, according to reports. Israel and the U.S. have a close intelligence-sharing relationship, but the Israeli Secret Service personnel had been warned not to share sensitive details with the Trump White House. They didn't listen and live to regret it. During that meeting with Lavrov and then-Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak, President Trump revealed the details of a covert Israeli operation that exposed ISIS plans to create laptop bombs and smuggle them aboard commercial airliners. U.S. reporters were barred from the meeting. The only images that documented it were taken by Russia's TASS news agency. Israeli intelligence experts say that the anti-ISIS mission actually took place in February of 2017. Two helicopters flew a team of Israeli commandos and Mossad operatives deep into Syria to gain information on a new ISIS weapon. They landed and went in vehicles with Syrian army markings before bugging an ISIS cell and then getting out. Unit 8200, Israel's Signals Intelligence Corps, monitored the listening devices for several days and then struck gold. An ISIS soldier explained how to create a bomb from a laptop that would fool airport security. Israel quickly shared the details with the U.S. A widespread ban on carrying laptops on planes was announced to travelers in March of 2017. And then, 2 months later, Trump told his Russian guests the specific city in northern Syria that had been targeted, though not apparently the nation that carried it out. The Russians quickly figured out that part themselves. Israel was named as the source of the intelligence in U.S. media reports at the time. U.S. National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster said then that the president wasn't even aware where this information came from, wasn't briefed on the sources and methods. At no time were intelligence sources or methods discussed, he said. The president did not disclose any military operations that were not already publicly known. I was in the room. It didn't happen. Only, apparently, that was a lie, and it did. On the other hand, President Trump himself later said he had the absolute right to share the intelligence with the Russians. An Israeli official, however, said, "We have an arrangement with America which is unique to the world of intelligence sharing. We do not have this relationship with any other country. To know that this intelligence is shared with others without our prior knowledge, that is for us our worst fears confirmed." In other news, one of the truly extraordinary people in the Jewish world died last week, Rabbi Neil Gilman, most important theologian in the conservative movement for the past two or three decades and a past guest of Too Jewish. In many ways, what was most extraordinary about Neil Gilman was that he was such a down-to-earth, warm, decent man. Not as famous as many lesser minds, he made important breakthroughs in contemporary belief accessible and understandable to everyone. Neil Gilman gave rabbis, rabbinical students, and, you know, plain old congregants new ways to understand and talk about God, meaning, and life after death. Across all movements of contemporary Judaism, he was an important advocate within the conservative movement for the ordination of women and gays. A professor of Jewish philosophy at the Jewish Theological Seminary in Manhattan for 46 years and dean of its rabbinical school for 10 years, Neil Gilman began publishing his work in the 1980s. Then, as now, the centrist conservative movement was struggling with identity and appeal, wondering if adherents were just stopping over on their way to becoming non-observant Jews whose allegiance was just ethnic. It was a movement, Gilman said, honestly, that consisted of an Orthodox faculty teaching conservative rabbis to minister to Reform Jews. Gilman's ideas helped generations of rabbis, teachers, and scholars define their own enigmatic ideas about God and faith. His breakthrough for thinking about God began with his notion of a second naivete. Gilman wanted his listeners to rediscover that childlike, innocent sense of awe and wonder, but in ways that made sense to adults. "Consider the image of God in the story of Abraham and Sodom and Gomorrah," Neil Gilman wrote. "God deliberates, is conflicted, has feelings, invites consultation, is willing to change the divine plan, is open to negotiation, needs to be true to previous commitments. Above all, God has an intense relationship with an individual human being." That was an existentialist conception rabbinical students could like. Whether the biblical stories were historically factual was less important than the values they conveyed. Rabbi Gilman's book, Sacred Fragments, Recovering Theology for the Modern Jew, won the National Jewish Book Award for Jewish Thought in 1990. In the 1970s, when the conservative movement began debating whether to expand women's roles, Gilman clashed with traditionalist colleagues and championed female ordination to the rabbinate. That became true in 1983, when the seminary approved women's ordination and became real in 1985 with the ordination of the first woman rabbi in the conservative movement. Gilman also argued for the ordination of gay, bisexual, and lesbian rabbis, which the movement finally approved in 2006. Same-sex marriage ceremonies were approved in the conservative movement in 2012, long after the reform movement, but still. Neil Gilman, a genial guy with a white goatee, threw ideas around with students in an office crammed with books. Those ideas reached beyond rabbinical circles to laypeople through his frequent scholar-in-residence weekends at Reform, Reconstructionist, and Conservative synagogues. I personally had the privilege of hosting Neil Gilman here in Tucson. He was as easy to get along with as he was erudite, funny, and intellectually captivating. His book, The Death of Death, Resurrection and Immortality in Jewish Thought, in that book, Gilman chronicled the evolution of Jewish ideas on death and the afterlife. It is by far the best book about life after death and Jewish belief ever written. I have used it regularly to teach from for the last 20 years. Neil Gilman was born and grew up in Quebec City, majored in philosophy at McGill University in Montreal, where he heard Will Herberg, the great sociologist of religion, speak about Jewish philosophy and decided to pursue the subject. He was advised to ground himself in Jewish texts first, did so at the Jewish Theological Seminary. He was influenced there by Mordechai Kaplan and Abraham Joshua Heschel, and he had great stories about both of them. As Gilman himself said, he started at JTS in New York in the mid-50s and never left. Ordained in 1960, he was soon teaching seminary students. He got his doctorate in philosophy at Columbia University nearby, and Neil Gilman taught all of us ever since. Zecher Tzadik Livracha, may his memory continue to bring blessing. Reviving an anti-Semitic slander buried a full century ago, a Russian justice ministry official repeated a local bishop's claim that Jews murdered the last Tsar of Russia for diabolic ritual purposes, spurring protests by Russia's largest Jewish groups. All this happened last week. Marina Molodstova, senior investigator for a special ministerial committee on the 1918 slaying of Tsar Nicholas II of Russia, said at a Moscow conference last week that her committee will conduct a psycho-historical examination to find out whether the execution of the Russian royal family was a ritual murder. At the same event, Father Tikhon Shevkunov, a Russian Orthodox Church bishop, said that according to the most rigorous approach to the version of ritual murder, a significant part of the Church Commission on Nicholas II's killing has no doubt this murder was ritual. The Federation of Jewish Communities of Russia, a Chabad-affiliated group with 100 communities across Russia, called the suggestion a shocking expression of an anti-Semitic myth. We all think this is absolutely unacceptable, the Federation's spokesman, Boruch Garagorin, said, and are shocked first and foremost by the sheer absurdity of these allegations. The Euro-Asian Jewish Congress also condemned the comments. Claims that the last Romanov Tsar, Nicholas II, was killed by Jews for ritual purposes had been limited to a fringe of nutcase zealous anti-Semites and promoters of unsophisticated conspiracy theories, but not anymore. Amid rising nationalism and nostalgia for Tsarist times under President Vladimir Putin, a Russian court in 2010 ordered prosecutors to reopen an investigation into the murder of the Tsar and his family, although the Bolsheviks, the radical wing of the Communist Party that led the country following the 1917 Russian Revolution, the Bolsheviks who shot them in 1918 have been dead for a very long time. The prevalence of Jews in the ranks of the Russian Revolution has remained a mainstay of anti-Semitic vitriol in Russia. During the Holocaust, it was a pretext for the murder of countless Jews all across Eastern Europe by self-proclaimed enemies of communism and Russia, despite the fact that communists severely oppressed Jews and ruthlessly prevented any public expression of Judaism in Russia. Nicholas II's killers were obviously committed atheists who rejected any belief in any force except their own, said Gorin, a senior aide to Beryl Lazar, chief rabbi of Russia. But blaming the Jews for the Tsar's death is an absolutely anti-Semitic myth used in anti-Semitic propaganda for several decades, which is why Jews view this with great concern. And they should. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Rabbi Steve Leder, is a senior rabbi of Wilshire Boulevard Temple in Los Angeles, one of the largest and most important congregations in the world, and he's one of the most important congregational rabbis in America. His new book is called More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms Us. It's not his first book. He's written about the way that we see the ordinary world and what real wealth in this world means and many other subjects. Steve, in writing about suffering, you know, it always has seemed to me that when I counsel people who've had a traumatic or tragic loss, I start by saying, you know, I sympathize. I haven't been in that position. I can't empathize fully. I don't usually say that part, but that's true. Does your increased understanding of pain, has that changed your rabbinate in other ways? And I know you talk about that some in your book.
It has. You know, for the first 27 years of my rabbinate, I did my best to help people who were in terribly painful situations. But it really wasn't until I experienced intense physical pain followed by emotional pain myself that I really had a much better understanding of the anxiety of pain, the loneliness of pain, the hopelessness at times of pain. And I was able to tune into that frequency in people much more effectively and much more authentically. And also, now that I'm 3 years past, you know, that terrible car accident and spinal surgery that followed, now that I'm past that, I'm also to speak with great integrity and authenticity about how these painful experiences can actually result in the most powerful and beautiful changes in our lives. You know, in the book, I talk about the fact that everyone is broken, but if you're willing to take this journey, there's a new kind of wholeness that emerges from that brokenness that isn't possible any other way. And it's very, very powerful and beautiful.
It has always seemed to me that virtually every biblical character goes through some great trauma. Jacob, of course, wrestling match, losing his son, and yet emerging as Israel. We can almost trace every single character as having deep tsoras that they come through. But we don't really talk about that much. I wonder why not.
Well, I do. I talk about it a lot.
Go ahead.
You know, I end the book by saying that there's a kind of saying among clergy that every preacher has one sermon that he gives 100 different ways.
Right.
And frankly, pretty much everything I've ever preached about, written about, talked about has to do with how we can create a sense of wholeness out of brokenness, how we can transform our suffering and our pain into a more beautiful life. And frankly, that's ultimately what our ancestors were about. You know, Yaakov becomes Yisrael, right? Yisrael, you know, these are, Avram becomes Avraham, Sarai becomes Sarah. These are transformative experiences that can change us and our lives for the better. And that's not, by the way, to idealize pain. You know, I have a friend I talk about in the book who had three different forms of cancer, and the third cancer killed him. And I was visiting him in the hospital when he was dying of that third cancer, and he looked up at me from his hospital bed and he said, "You know, Steve, this much character I don't need."
Yeah.
So, right, I'm not. This isn't a book about, you know, sort of the idealization of suffering, and suffering is just a step on the path toward an enlightened life. No, I wish no one suffered ever. But the fact is, to be human is to suffer. Now the question is, what are you going to do about it? Not why do we suffer? That's a cul-de-sac, and you just go around and around and around. But what are you going to do? Dostoevsky said his greatest fear was that his life would not be worthy of his suffering. Can you lead a life worthy of your suffering, worthy of what you learned going and walking through that fire? That's the question. And the answer is always yes. If you take this invitation that pain offers you seriously.
I want to ask a difficult question. Opioid addiction is now a huge story. Even 3 years ago when you went through it, it wasn't such a big story.
Yeah.
What was more difficult, the physical pain of the agony from the back injury and the surgeries, or fighting the addiction?
I would say that the back injury and the resulting nerve damage and pain was physically more painful. The opioids were emotionally more painful. I've always been an optimistic, can-do person, always punched above my weight, got things done. There was nothing I thought I couldn't do. And the opioids caused a depression, the likes of which I had never felt in my life before. I didn't even have a name for it, for the way I felt. It was so dark and heavy and hopeless, and I just didn't see a way out. So I would say emotionally, that was more difficult. And I was one of the lucky ones. I was able to just stop. You know, when I realized what they were doing to me, I stopped. I did go through withdrawal. I was sick and miserable for, 2-3 weeks. But I consider myself, frankly, one of the lucky ones. Because I'll tell you, I understand this now in a whole new way. When you are in that kind of pain, when you are being tortured, essentially, you'll eat those things like candy, anything. To be able to not scream. And of course, I pretended I was fine. I pretended I was sleeping. I went to work. And it was all a charade and a kind of kabuki. And one of the things that my experience helped me change in my life was, I stopped the kabuki theater. And that's not easy for a rabbi.
There's a phrase that people use a lot that I have kind of come to hate, which is God never gives you more than you can handle.
Yeah.
That's not always true, is it? Yeah.
Well, first of all, it implies that God is somehow picking and choosing who suffers and who doesn't and in what way and to what degree, which I completely reject.
Right.
I utterly reject that. Who needs that God?
Yeah.
So that's, I don't even accept the premise that God is the one who grants this suffering. If you don't want to suffer, don't be human. This is what the Rambam said. Be an inanimate object. To be human is to suffer decline. We all fall apart, all of us. To act on nature means nature will act upon us. And if you don't like it, be a table or a chair. So this is not God's fault. This is what it means to be a human being. It's baked into our essence. And I don't believe in a God that, picks and chooses the degree and timing of suffering for people. Who needs that kind of God? So that's the first thing I reject. And there are degrees of suffering that some people really cannot withstand because they don't reach out for help. There's a piece in the book called The Prisoner Cannot Free Himself. And, if you're not able to reach out, there are certain forms of pain from which you cannot rescue yourself. One of the intimate things that pain can teach us is to pour it out to the people we love, to trust them, that they can hold our pain with us, they can walk with us, they can carry us, and they will. But there are certain forms of pain, that people just cannot take. So I reject both the first and the second half of the statement. Suicide is an example of a pain that someone just could not bear.
Right.
In Auschwitz, there were people who threw themselves on the electrified fence.
Yeah, it was the way out.
I'm not here to be judgmental about that. It was the only solution they could manage. So, and I'm not judgmental about it. So I reject, frankly, both sides of that equation.
You quote Milton Steinberg, quoted by Dennis Prager at one point in the book, a kind of important quote. The religious person has to explain why the innocent suffer. The atheist has to explain everything else.
Right. Right.
Innocent people are going to suffer. What do you say to people who say they just can't handle it?
I would say you can't handle it alone, but you can handle it if you're willing to reach out to people who love you, to professionals who can care for you, I could never have written this book had I not been under the care of a very talented psychiatrist from whom I learned so much about myself and about the journey through suffering. You can if you're willing to reach out. And the other thing, I think it's very important when people are experiencing pain to take them back to previous painful experiences and disappointments and losses and ask them, how did you survive that? Because clearly you did. And to remind them of the internal and external resources they used the last time they were suffering. And that they can, in fact, summon those resources again. You know, pain does not rob you of your intelligence. It doesn't rob you of your relationships. It doesn't rob you of the help that's available to you if you're willing to reach out. So I would say you can. You can because you must. And it's also very important in terms of the theological issue. I think it's very important to move people as quickly as possible off of the why question. Yes, innocent people suffer. No, you did not deserve this. But why? Why is the wrong question? Because there's no answer to that question. Unless you're a fundamentalist and say, well, this is all part of God's great plan. You know, unless you're Job and it's God's answer to Job, which is very comforting and works for a lot of people. But if you're dealing with someone for whom it does not work, you have to move them off of the why question quickly to what? What, given that this has happened to me, am I going to do about it? How am I going to change my life? Who am I going to reach out to? The what, the how, the who are much more productive questions than why me.
There's a powerful point you make, final question here, about humility, about the need for suffering and that change to come from humility. When you're suffering, it's very, very difficult to feel somehow both humble. This must be really challenging psychologically, no?
It's a terrible feeling, I think, a frightening feeling, when pain comes, to realize how little control we have in many ways over what happens to us and over life itself. It's a great lesson in humility. But if properly absorbed and understood, this humility can lead to a much greater sense of empathy for others. It can lead to a much greater sense of gratitude for every day that is not your last. It can also lead to a greater sense of acceptance of what's happening to you, of a peacemaking. And this is part of healing, is making peace with what we cannot change, because guess what? You really are only human.
It's a beautiful book, more beautiful than before, How Suffering Transforms Us, our Rabbi Steve Leder. I want to thank you, Steve, for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about the book and more about you?
The easiest thing for the book is to go to Amazon.com and type in More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms Us, or type in Steve Leder, and it'll take you right to the book. I think that's the easiest. I'm kind of an old dude, so I'm not a big social media or website guy, but we are building a website called More Beautiful Than Before. It's just not ready yet.
Yes,
because I don't know what I'm doing.
What more electrons than before?
Go to Amazon.com and find the book. And also, look, I think this is one of those books that is more important to hand to someone who's suffering than a bouquet of flowers.
It's sort
this
of
book really help people, so give it to your friends who are suffering.
It's kind of the Harold Kushner's When Bad Things Happen to Good People for a New Generation. Great book. Thanks again. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be the delightful writer A.J. Jacobs of the Year of Living Biblically fame, the author of the new book, It's All Relative. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish for the coming holiday of Hanukkah is from cantor Ben-Sion Miller, an upbeat version of Maoz Sur composed by the late Aaron Miller. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace. Sir yeshi yusir khuno vel shabaya tikkan bay stefilo sev shom toydon zabaya yas tu khun mar baya mitzor na baya ozek ma bishir miz mor khani kasam iz baya ru voy sovon af shi be yogoin koy khikin khayay mar li be kishir shi be de mal khzeglo give you do yak do lo voy si es askin khal paroy ve khol zaroy די קלייבן בימ צילו דיר קוצוי אביאני וגם שום לא שוקטתי יבון נוי גייס ויגלן ניקי זור מובדתי ויין רעל מוסחתי כמעט שיוברתי תאית בובל זרי בובל קייצי ומנושותי כרויס קוימס ורויש ביקה שגוגי.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.